Chapter 27. Such matchless coloring! Such feeling! What delicacy of touch! What sublimity of conception! A vision! A vision! I only envy these people, I envy them their honest admiration, if it be honest their delight, if they feel delight. I harbor no animosity toward any of them. But at the same time the thought will intrude itself upon me, how can they see what is not visible? What would you think of a man who looked at some decayed, blind, toothless, pockmarked Cleopatra, and said, colon, what matchless beauty! What soul! What expression! What would you think of a man who gazed upon a dingy, foggy sunset, and said, what sublimity! What feeling! What richness of coloring! What would you think of a man who stared in ecstasy upon a desert of stumps and said, colon, oh, my soul, my beating heart, what a noble forest is here! You would think that those men had an astonishing talent for seeing things that had already passed away. It was what I thought when I stood before the Last Supper and heard men apostrophizing wonders and beauties and perfections which had faded out of the picture and gone 100 years before they were born. We can imagine the beauty that was once in an aged face. We can imagine the forest if we see the stumps. But we cannot absolutely see these things when they are not there. I am willing to believe that the eye of the practiced artist can rest upon the Last Supper and renew a luster where only a hint of it is left, supply a tint that has faded away, restore an expression that is gone, patch and color and add to the dull canvas until at last its figures shall stand before him aglow with the life, the feeling, the freshness, yea, with all the noble beauty that was theirs when first they came from the hand of the master. But I cannot work this miracle. Can those other uninspired visitors do it, or do they only happily imagine they do? After reading so much about it, I am satisfied that the Last Supper was a very miracle of art once. But it was 300 years ago. It vexes me to hear people talk so glibly of feeling, expression, tone, and those other easily acquired and inexpensive technicalities of art that make such a fine show in conversations concerning pictures. There is not one man in 7,500 that can tell what a pictured face is intended to express. There is not one man in 500 that can go into a courtroom and be sure that he will not mistake some harmless innocent of a juryman for the black-hearted assassin on trial. Yet such people talk of character and presume to interpret expression in pictures. There is an old story that Matthews, the actor, was once lauding the ability of the human face to express the passions and emotions hidden in the breast. He said the countenance could disclose what was passing in the heart plainer than the tongue could. Now, he said, observe my face, what does it express? Despair. Bah, it expresses peaceful resignation. What does this express? Rage. Stuff. It means terror. This. Imbecility. Fool. It is smothered ferocity. Now this. Joy. Oh, perdition. Any ass can see it means insanity. Expression. People coolly pretend to read it who would think themselves presumptuous if they pretended to interpret the hieroglyphics on the obelisks of Luxor, yet they are fully as competent to do the one thing as the other. I have heard two very intelligent critics speak of Murillo's Immaculate Conception now in the museum at Seville, within the past few days. One said, oh, the Virgin's face is full of the ecstasy of a joy that is complete, that leaves nothing more to be desired on earth. The other said, ah, that wonderful face is so humble, so pleading, it says as plainly as words could say it, I fear, I tremble, I am unworthy. But thy will be done, sustain thou thy servant. Apostrophe, the reader can see the picture in any drawing room, it can be easily recognized. The Virgin, the only young and really beautiful Virgin that was ever painted by one of the old masters, some of us think, stands in the crescent of the new moon, with a multitude of cherubs hovering about her, and more coming, Her hands are crossed upon her breast, and upon her uplifted countenance falls a glory out of the heavens. The reader may amuse himself, if he chooses, in trying to determine which of these gentlemen read the Virgin's expression aright, or if either of them did it. Anyone who is acquainted with the old masters will comprehend how much the Last Supper is damaged when I say that the spectator cannot really tell now whether the disciples are Hebrews or Italians. These ancient painters never succeeded in denationalizing themselves. The Italian artists painted Italian virgins, the Dutch painted Dutch virgins, the virgins of the French painters were French women. None of them ever put into the face of the Madonna that indescribable something which proclaims the Jewess, whether you find her in New York, in Constantinople, in Paris, Jerusalem, or in the Empire of Morocco. I saw in the Sandwich Islands, once, a picture copied by a talented German artist from an engraving in one of the American illustrated papers. It was an allegory, representing Mr. Davis in the act of signing a secession act or some such document. Over him hovered the ghost of Washington in warning attitude, and in the background a troop of shadowy soldiers in Continental uniform were limping with shoeless, bandaged feet through a driving snowstorm. Valley Forge was suggested, of course. The copy seemed accurate, and yet there was a discrepancy somewhere. After a long examination I discovered what it was. The shadowy soldiers were all Germans. Jeff Davis was a German. Even the hovering ghost was a German ghost. The artist had unconsciously worked his nationality into the picture. To tell the truth, I am getting a little perplexed about John the Baptist and his portraits. In France I finally grew reconciled to him as a Frenchman. Here he is unquestionably an Italian. What next? Can it be possible that the painters make John the Baptist a Spaniard in Madrid and an Irishman in Dublin? We took an open barouche and drove 2 miles out of Milan to Easy Echo, as the guide expressed it. The road was smooth, it was bordered by trees, fields, and grassy meadows, and the soft air was filled with the odor of flowers. Troops of picturesque peasant girls, coming from work, hooted at us, shouted at us, made all manner of game of us, and entirely delighted me. My long-cherished judgment was confirmed. I always did think those frosty, romantic, unwashed peasant girls I had read so much about in poetry were a glaring fraud. We enjoyed our jaunt. It was an exhilarating relief from tiresome sightseeing. We distressed ourselves very little about the astonishing echo the guide talked so much about. We were growing accustomed to encomiums on wonders that too often proved no wonders at all. And so we were most happily disappointed to find in the sequel that the guide had even failed to rise to the magnitude of his subject. We arrived at a tumble-down old rookery, called the Palazzo Simonetti, a massive hewn stone affair occupied by a family of ragged Italians. A good-looking young girl conducted us to a window on the second floor which looked out on a court walled on three sides by tall buildings. She put her head out at the window and shouted. The echo answered more times than we could count. She took a speaking trumpet, and through it she shouted, sharp and quick, a single A. The echo answered. Ha! 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 Dash ha! Ha! H-A-A-A-A-A! And finally went off into a rollicking convulsion of the jolliest laughter that could be imagined. It was so joyful, so long-continued, so perfectly cordial and hearty, that everybody was forced to join in. There was no resisting it. Then the girl took a gun and fired it. We stood ready to count the astonishing clatter of reverberations. We could not say 1, 2, 3, fast enough, but we could dot our notebooks with our pencil points almost rapidly enough to take down a sort of shorthand report of the result. My page revealed the following account. I could not keep up, but I did as well as I could. I set down 52 distinct repetitions, and then the echo got the advantage of me. The doctor set down 64, and thenceforth the echo moved too fast for him, also. After the separate concussions could no longer be noted, the reverberations dwindled to a wild, long-sustained clatter of sound such as a watchman's rattle produces. It is likely that this is the most remarkable echo in the world. The doctor, in jest, offered to kiss the young girl, and was taken a little aback when she said he might for a franc. The commonest gallantry compelled him to stand by his offer, and so he paid the franc, and took the kiss. She was a philosopher. She said a franc was a good thing to have, and she did not care anything for one paltry kiss, because he had a million left. Then our comrade, always a shrewd businessman, offered to take the whole cargo at 30 days, but that little financial scheme was a failure. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.